Hi, everyone, and welcome to our podcast, Gateways, a Lifeline for a Lifetime. I'm Joanne Sheehan, your host. I've been part of Gateways for many years, and I'm excited to share stories, insights, and conversations that shine a light on the work we do and the people we serve. For those of you who are unfamiliar with us, Gateways Community Services is a nonprofit organization that has been part of the greater Nashua community for over 40 years, supporting more than 2,800 individuals with developmental disabilities, children with developmental delays, autism, and aging adults. This series is all about pulling back the curtain on the developmental disability support structure, answering the questions you've always wondered about but may not have known who to ask. From services and supports to career paths and personal stories, we're here to share the real experiences that define our work at Gateways. In today's episode, we're exploring the full range of services Gateways Community Services offers to support children from birth through age 22. From early intervention for infants and toddlers to family support for school-aged children and transition planning for teens entering adulthood, we'll walk through how we partner with families through every phase of the development. We'll also be highlighting the Gateways Autism Center, an outstanding program that provides on-site applied behavioral analysis, ABA therapy, and a supportive family-centered environment where children can thrive and caregivers feel truly empowered. Be sure to stay tuned until the end of this episode when we'll hear the personal stories of our guests. They not only run critical service programs here at Gateways, but are also mothers of children with disabilities. They'll share their personal stories and how they balance the roles of both provider and parent in navigating the system. Joining me today are two incredible guests, Jillian Alexis and Caitlin Copeland. Jillian is a family support supervisor who has been with Gateways Community Services for 7 years. She has helped to grow the family support program and provide resources, referrals, and lots of support to many families with children aged 3 to 22. Jillian is dedicated to advocating for family support families and ensuring their voices are heard and supported. Jillian also has personal experience and is very involved in the developmental disabilities community outside of Gateways, where she provides a lot of guidance and support to families and individuals seeking it. Caitlin is a board-certified behavioral analyst and senior director of Gateways Community Services. She oversees children's services, including Gateways Autism Center, early supports and services, family support, and healthcare coordination. Caitlin shares personal experience and is dedicated to empowering families to support their child's developmental progress through evidence-based compassionate care. Welcome, everybody. Caitlin, we'll start with you. Tell me about Gateways Autism Center and what inspired its creation.
So Gateways Autism Center is located at our Canal Street office building, and it serves individuals under the age of 6 years old. It's a one-to-one program, meaning one staff to one child, and we use applied behavior analysis throughout our program to teach children life skills, potty training, communication, and it was started within Gateways just over 10 years ago.
Wow. I didn't realize it happened that long. Yeah. Tell me what applied behavior analysis is.
So it's a science-based way of teaching, or evidence-based way of teaching children and breaking down tasks that individuals need to learn. We use positive reinforcement to teach life skills. We take data on everything, whether that be maladaptive behaviors, waving your hand to say hi, making eye contact, and we use different types of devices and tools to help figure out which way a learner should communicate best.
Cool. Can you tell me what would a typical day for a child look like when they come to the Autism Center, depending on what goals are set forth for that child?
Yeah, so every child has an individualized program that a board-certified behavior analyst overseas, so that we'll refer to that as a BCBA, and they oversee the child's program from the day that they start until the day that they leave our center and transition into the public school environment. And that program is crafted with goals based on assessments that have been run by the BCBA and parent input onto what is important for the parent and what's important that this child learn in their first years of being a child, right? And a lot of those goals focus on communication, social skills, building friendships, pre-academic skills. And during the day, they travel throughout our center to various rooms. We have a wonderful imaginative play space. We have our toleration room that has a working dentist and doctor and haircut area. We have a lunchroom, and we even have a mock classroom that we run classroom time in this setting. So we're really trying to, in that environment, in a controlled setting, prepare these children for public school with hopefully less supports than they would have needed.
That's great. How do families kind of participate? Like, where do they come into play, as you know, in their learning?
Yeah, so parent training or family coaching is a huge part, right? You know, we are with the children from anywhere from 15 to 35 hours a week, but their parents are with them all the time. We need to make sure that the goals we're working on can generalize into those home environments or the community environments. So within that plan that we create with the parents, we'll have goals for them. Maybe they need to learn how to bring a certain goal home. Maybe the child's struggling with walking in a grocery store, or using the bathroom at home, or requesting food with their voice or a device of some sort. And we actually have staff that go to the home or the community with the parents and show them how to run it, show them how to take data if that's something that they're willing to do. And, you know, to go on our toleration room, we go with them to the dentist or the doctor's office to make sure that, and we bring the parents into our setting first, and then we actually go to the real dentist or doctor's visit so that we can run it the same way. And same with our haircut. We've actually had hairstylists come into our center because that's where the child's comfortable and perform the haircut. Now, that's not our end goal. Our end goal is to get them out in the community. But we will go out in the community and do that as well.
So the parent will actually come to the autism center, say they're,
absolutely,
you know, they have an appointment set up for the dentist. So the ABA or the BCBA?
The BCBA.
Will practice that appointment in that room with the parents, mm-hmm, so they can be prepared to take their child.
Correct. And then the BCBA will also go, if the parent wants them to the actual appointment.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. Have you had success at children?
Yeah, we've had a ton of success. We've had children that, you know, they were scared to sit in a dentist chair, sit in the haircut chair, get full haircuts and get full dental appointments in that environment, in the natural environment. And when you think about it and you really break it down, you get a haircut, an individual gets a haircut at the most probably every 8 weeks if you're a young boy with a short haircut, and you go to the dentist twice a year. So these are very novel experiences. It's not something you do all the time. When we can bring it in our environment and do it every single day with them, it becomes natural. Mm-hmm. It's something that we just do every day.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I want to talk about the new sensory room. Tell me a little bit about that.
So the imaginative playroom. So that room is, we have a cause and effect area. We have a grocery store in it, and it's all child-sized grocery store and a child-sized cafe. And we have this train table the kids love to play with. And it's not, you know, learning, it's learning through play. Mm-hmm. And we're not just there to sit down at a desk and match colors and match pictures and match objects. So what we did in that room is we brought those programs to life in that room. So it's not match this piece of paper to another piece of paper. It's, can you find where the apples go? Go put them back in the grocery store. Let's restock those shelves. Or let's, you know, let's go and make this pretend smoothie with our fake blender and serve it to people and ask them if they want it. And they're learning while playing, and it's a really beautiful thing to see.
Do the kids love it?
They love it. They all request it every day. They
price
it
all day there. I feel like I would love it, too. That would probably be my favorite place to play if I was a kid. Yeah. Tell me about the Sib Shop. I'm excited to hear about that.
All right. So, so Sib Shop, it started within this year, I would guess. But it's something that we started to allow siblings a safe space to meet other siblings. And when we really think about the individuals that Gateways, not just the Autism Center, but Gateways as a whole serves, we serve families and we serve individuals with developmental disabilities, and sometimes their siblings get lost, so we kind of provide them with that space. And it's a curriculum-based sibling support group, and it's a national program. We're part of the Sib Shop program, and they meet monthly, and we have this really cute group of core four girls. There's four of them, and their age is between 6, 5, and 8, I think. And they look forward to meeting together, and they talk about feelings or what it's like to be a sibling of someone with a disability. And, you know, why last night my brother screamed all night. Well, mine did too. And, you know, have that place where someone else gets it. And in a world where that's not typically the norm, and a lot of them have friends that are individuals who are, you know, not neurodivergent and are neurotypical, they don't have that same compassion or same understanding when they have play dates. And it creates this place of I'm not alone for them. And when we really started to dig into research around siblings, as it started to become a passion, we realize that siblings are with individuals their entire life, even after, you know, after parents. That is their person. Mm-hmm. And these siblings become caregivers most of the time, whether or not they chose to be. Mm-hmm. And we need to set them up with the education, the empowerment of making decisions, and also being a part of the decision-making place at a younger age. I think that's really what this does.
I really love that. And how does it relate to like the inclusiveness of the entire family, the Sib Shop, with siblings going to the Sib Shop and, you know, relating with their, you know, their entire family?
Yeah, like I said, it brings up that, you know, I'm not alone. You know, there's other people that have siblings that, you know, display other types of behaviors or can't relate to me in the same way or don't play with me in the same way as I see. We have done a couple times where we've had like the families meet up and get ice cream or something like that. But we want to make sure that the Sib Shop space is just for siblings. So we've been pretty clear with that boundary. And it's their safe space. Their brother, they all have brothers on the autism spectrum, but their brothers aren't coming to Sib Shop. It's their space.
Okay. Does it help the sibling kind of relate with the parent and vice versa? Because I know sometimes parents have a lot of guilt, you know, around having a child, you know, with autism, and it's mm-hmm. always about them and, you know, not about the sibling. And it's not, you know, on purpose, but
yeah, I think it gives the siblings a space, right? You know, your sibling needs to go to all these therapy appointments or has all these extra things that, you know, we don't know what they are and it's special for them and you can't go. And this gives them something that they get to go to and is special for them. But I think also it brings, sometimes having these conversations, you know, they're young little girls, but the conversations they have are big. And it's like they start to understand like, okay, now I get why I have to clean up my dinner and my brother doesn't. Or I get why he gets an iPad when we go out to restaurants and I don't. You know, mm-hmm. they start to have that understanding and realize that the things that equal does not mean the same. And that's a really hard thing to learn mm-hmm. at 5, 6, 7, 8, you know.
Yeah.
And what the responsibilities are. And we hear from the little girls. You know, there's little girls who say all different funny things, but one of them was like, I have to help my mom because my dad's away and my brother can't. And that is, when you think about that at an 8-year-old saying that, and they don't mean, parents, from the parent's perspective, they're not meaning to add that weight onto their child, but that's what it comes out as to the child's perspective. But they have a place to share that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I love it. I love it for the siblings. Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about Early Supports and Services, also known as ESS. I'm going to start with, you know, what are Early Supports and Services and who are they designed to support?
So our Early Supports and Services program is our Birth to Three program in the state of New Hampshire, and it serves individuals from the time they're born until they're 3 years old. And it serves any individual that's experiencing a pretty significant delay, or has a medical diagnosis or complexity that meets a threshold for needing early intervention services. That's who it serves.
And what kinds of therapies or support might a family or individual receive through ESS?
So our ESS program it occurs in the natural environment. So the program itself would occur at the family's or caregiver's home, sometimes at a playground, library. We try to get it in a natural environment. And the providers are, we have educators, occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech and language pathologists, and we also have someone who does vision and hearing. But our therapists work on an interdisciplinary model. So what that means is that if they are an occupational therapist, they also have been taught skill sets from our speech and language pathologists. They're not just at an appointment working on, let's say, an occupational therapist working on fine motor skills. They are also looking at the development of that child in total. What are they doing for communication or social, or what are they doing with their gross motor? It's not very specific therapy. It's more about that individual's development.
Okay. So I'm assuming they're assessed mm-hmm. First, and then they make a plan.
Yep. So anyone can refer to our ESS program. So a lot of times it's parents or primary care physicians mm-hmm. making that referral because they notice something. And an evaluation will take place. If the individual is eligible, services will begin based on the recommendation of the team. If the individual is not eligible at this time, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't come back. If there's concerns, always come back. But that's what the process kind of looks like. It does take some time to set up, fill out the paperwork, set up the evaluation, start the therapy process. But that's kind of what it looks like.
Are you referring to the intake process
yes.
itself? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to ask, insurance, is ESS or Gateway's Autism Center eligible for insurance, private insurance, or?
So our Gateway's Autism Center is paid through by third-party insurance, so parents could still be responsible for deductibles or co-pays or any of those expenses, out-of-pocket expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Our Early Supports Services program, we do need funding through insurance, so we do ask for permission to bill insurance. However, it is a state and federally funded program. What that means is that if, for say, you have third-party insurance and it says you're going to get a $25 deductible for or $25 copay for every visit, is that you won't actually pay that copay. That copay would be covered by the state in federal funds.
Oh, okay.
But we would still bill the insurance for the visit.
Okay. And just lastly, you know, why is early intervention so important, and what's the ultimate goal for a child who receives these services?
So early intervention is crucial. I think it's, you know, we think about all the services that Gateways provides, and I don't want to be one to pick one, but this program, it sets individuals up for success later on. And there's so much data around, you know, early intervention and needing less supports in school, early intervention and needing less supports as adulthood. And as Gateways, as a community service who provides throughout the lifetime, when we put in upfront for these young learners, we know that they most likely will need less supports later on in life. And how wonderful will that be when they're contributing as adults? So that's, I guess, what I would say is like the most important thing about early intervention. Like I said, I'm not going to pick one, but it's
pretty
important.
Have you ever had a child like just graduate from early
Absolutely.
Support services?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's as needed as much as the individual needs. You know, sometimes we do get individuals in and we're able to provide this parent coaching model to the family, and they start to talk and they start to meet these milestones and they don't need us anymore. And how wonderful is that? And that's fantastic when that happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, same thing. We see a lot of young children who might display, we'll say, like torticollis or a gross motor delay, and now they're walking and they're fine, and they've kind of graduated from our ESS program. Mm-hmm.
That kind of segues me to Jillian. So if a child does need continued services after ESS, they go into family support. Is that correct?
Correct. So typically, if an individual is in ESS, Early Supports and Services, the Early Supports and Service Coordinator would talk with the family, explain what family support is about, and then do a referral to see if they would qualify. the big difference, I think, that's important to note, which is probably what you're going to ask me next, mm-hmm. is family support provides voluntary services to individuals who are eligible for ages 3 up until 22, or when they exit high school. And the real reason for that is because typically around the age of 3 is when individuals start to enter into school. Mm-hmm. So school kind of becomes that main entity, the main direct support. Providing those services, whether it's in school or they're getting outpatient services. So we're kind of there. We like to say we're like there as like that secondary support in the background. So with that being said, a lot of what we do is, I'm getting ahead of myself, aren't I? I know
that's okay.
Those are your
that's
questions.
Okay.
is really just like helping to make sure that they have the support they need as they start to get into the, early supports and services and family support can work together and collaborate to help make sure that their transition to the new school is successful and they get the services that they need in all of those pieces.
So when they start to transition from ESS to family support, do parents typically have a lot of questions or... Do you just look kind of like let the school system take over? Are you following that individual?
That's a good question. So it's up to the family how engaged they really want to be with family support. I think, early supports and services, their coordinators do a really good job at giving a very brief overview of what family support can offer. And then families kind of either choose to access those services or maybe they don't necessarily need to. Either way, when they come over to us, we do, introduce ourselves, offer to meet with them and explain what our services could look like and like what we're here for and what we can do versus like what we might not be able to do, but what we can help make sure that they still have that support they need.
Okay. Do you, first tell me what are kind of like the secondary resources that family support provides, and are you in the school system like in partnership with each other? Like, do you work together?
Good question. So we, we collaborate with the schools.
Okay.
Again, at a younger age, it's really up to how much the family wants us to be involved, because it can be a lot to have too many people involved in a team meeting. So we really leave that to the families. We do our best to make sure that they know that we are there and that that is something that we can provide. So a lot of what we do is we provide resources and referrals for individuals and families that need it. So say a family comes into us and they're like, we're not getting those services from the school that we were promised and we need help because we really don't understand this process. Once they've transitioned to us, we're more than happy to go to a meeting and kind of sit in. We aren't, a neutral party overall because we have that collaboration from both sides, the families and the school. So we go in there and we kind of just try to make sure that everyone's on the same page, understands like what's being asked and what's being given to make sure, because sometimes it's the same thing and they just need someone to say, oh, that's what you're saying. Okay, so we do understand that that's the need, or this is why that need isn't being met. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it just takes like a neutral person there to have that conversation. So as far as like the support that way, that's what we do a lot of. Sometimes it's not that smooth, and sometimes they do need more support. We are not educational advocates, so we cannot go in there and like and do that advocacy work, but we can definitely, if it ever got to that point, kind of give some resources if a family needed that, or they could always, you know, give, we have some other places that have other people that we have worked with in the past that we could refer them to.
Okay. And you also do some, you kind of do some fun things in family support. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So family support has a family support council that's made up of individuals and families with disabilities, or individuals with disabilities in their family. And they come together, they manage kind of like the services and supports that are provided to individuals with family support. So along with the fun events, which I'll get to, a lot of what the focus is around is some fiscal supports as well. So we have something called Medicaid Respite, and it's a reimbursement program. Recently switched a little bit as to how we fund that, but overall, it's a respite reimbursement is like, hey, I have a babysitter, I paid them, and we can reimburse you up to a certain amount. And the reason That's for that great. Is because ultimately, our individuals are going to need a little more support, right, than other individuals. Mm-hmm. So it's not as simple as I can just pay you a few bucks to watch my kid for a few hours. Sometimes their needs may be high and they need someone who's skilled, mm-hmm. they feel comfortable to leave their child with, you know, and it's a little bit harder for them to find that support, mm-hmm. right? And so that's a huge piece of it. Plus, lifelong, like as they get older, you know, your neurotypical child might be able to stay home alone at 12, 13, 14, whatever the age is these days. Our individuals often cannot. So that need gets to be more as they get older, mm-hmm. as well.
Yes.
Hopefully not, but mm-hmm. could. And we also offer something called discretionary funds. Mm-hmm. So discretionary funds helps cover a few different areas. It covers adaptive recreational classes or lessons. So individuals who might have a real interest in something, but also it could help them kind of gain skills. So for an example, I'll use dance class because that's what my son does. dance class, not only is it something he enjoys because he loves music, but he works on his social skills. He works on following directions. He works on being able to, you know, interact with people who might have different needs than him, things like that. And it gives them a sense of pride to be part of a group like that.
Is anybody eligible for the discretionary funds or the Medicaid respite?
Good question. So all of our individuals who are eligible for family support are able to access discretionary funds. Those are not part of the Medicaid respite. They're two separate. And also going back to respite real quick. So yeah. Someone who doesn't have Medicaid doesn't necessarily mean they can't access respite. There's two different types of funding for that.
Oh.
So they can still access respite even if they don't have Medicaid, because as we know, Medicaid can be pretty difficult to get for kiddos if they don't meet a certain criteria. So, and we acknowledge that.
Great.
But along with the discretionary funds, adaptive recreational lessons and classes, we cover like adaptive equipment. So this could be, it's really, I like to say it's more sensory based, because we aren't going to cover like, I shouldn't say we aren't, we should never say we aren't. But if it's a medical need, it's typically something we would help assist the family in getting covered through insurance.
Right.
And if it's educational, we would refer them back to the school to see if the school could cover it. So typically I say sensory because that's where majority I would say goes towards. So like a weighted blanket, or we've done like the bean bags, like those, what are they called? Where you like, it like you squeeze into it. It's like the pea pod ones, things mm-hmm. like that help kind of regulate individuals when they might be having a hard time, things like that. And the big piece I think along with this is it's basically anything that is going to support the individual in their disability that isn't covered by another entity. So we are like the payer of last resort, if you will, for those things.
Okay.
But we're always willing to consider something if it's something that the family has justification around mm-hmm. why it's needed.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So after a child moves through, you know, grade school, middle school, and they get to the end of their high school years, at age 22. Is that correct?
Sometimes. Yes.
So there's this thing, high school transition, and it's kind of like, well, I think it's kind of like a pivotal time in, you know, someone's life where there's like a lot of planning because they may enter into adult services. Can you kind of explain a little bit what happens around that time?
Sure. So the reason why I said sometimes is because typically we start to support individuals with transition planning when they get into high school. Everyone's trajectory is a little different. So some people in the state of New Hampshire, you have the right to stay in school until 22 if you're not on a general ed high school diploma track. So some of our individuals might be just getting a certificate of completion, which means that they may not meet the criteria for a general ed high school diploma, and then they'd be able to stay in school till 22. Some of our individuals do meet that criteria based off whatever factors. They meet that academic need, and then they may graduate 18, 19, what have you. So it could be that we're transitioning someone at 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. It really just depends on their need. I would say, you know, we do try to get involved around 15, 16 to really start to get more engaged, because like I said, we're voluntary services, so a lot of families may only reach out to us once in a while. They may not reach out to us at all because there's not really that need for those voluntary services in that time frame. But we do try to get more engaged once they get closer to like really considering what that future planning looks like.
So you try and get ahead of the curve before it happens, before that transition happens.
Especially when it comes to like person-centered planning. We do that informally throughout all of those high school years with our individuals. We often get more involved with the school, so we go to school meetings with them, really just to get to know the individual. And when I say get to know the individual, I mean like meeting the individual, not just hearing who they are on paper, because it's not the same. We also will, around 17 and a half, we start to have a conversation, maybe sooner, depending on the family's comfortability, around decision-making options. So oftentimes individuals, when you turn 18, you're an adult regardless of diagnosis. Some of our individuals may be okay with being their own guardian. Some may need a little more support when it comes to certain areas like financial or medical decision making, and some are not able to make decisions on their own and they require someone to continue to do that for them. So there's an array of options for decision making, and we can help educate the families on what those are, but ultimately the decision is the family's decision at the end of the day.
Okay. And what are kind of their options when they transition into adult services?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. everything's individualized, just like in an IEP for school, right? Everything's individualized to what that individual needs. We assist families in applying, like I said, figuring out the guardianship or the, you know, power of attorney, or maybe nothing at all, depending on the circumstances. And then we help them apply for the benefits that are required if they do feel they're going to need to access any services once high school is over. Mm-hmm. So that's Medicaid, Social Security, stuff like that. Some individuals will just want to go to high school. I mean, to high school. They're in high school. To college. And they just need a little bit of support to kind of prepare them for it. So we can refer them to programs like there's through the school collaborating with them to see what programs could they take leading up to graduating to get them ready for that. We also do a lot of collaborative work with vocational rehabilitation for individuals who might need some support in employment. So we do some of that. We also, for individuals who might require, you know, residential services, we look at that and what vendors in the community could support that need as they get to that age or that point, whether it be because of the individual's need or because something we're seeing a lot more of too is aging guardians, because maybe the grandparents are raising their child, so they're getting older and they're not really able to care for the needs of the individual anymore. So there's a lot of components.
So if an individual needs residential services or day program services, Do you work with other departments within Gateways to help make that happen, or is that something you Family Support does on their own?
So we typically start it with them, but we do work very closely with, we have two different adult models for transitioning into adult services. So we have PDMS, Participant Directed and Managed Services, and then we also have traditional service coordination. Do you want me to explain the difference between
those
two?
If you can, that would be great.
So Participant Directed and Managed Services, PDMS, is a more family or self-driven program where the family is kind of responsible for hiring staff, managing goals, and kind of creating their own schedule and kind of managing a budget. They have support from a service coordinator, but ultimately they have more flexibility and control over what those services would look like.
Okay.
They may or may not have a vendor involved, but typically they don't have a full-time day program and through a vendor involved, but it's a creative program, so you never know. And then the other one is traditional adult services. And oftentimes if an individual is going residential or is going to do like a full day program, and maybe the family's like, I don't want to manage a whole program. I just want them to have this vendor that they have services through. And that's the type of program that would go there. It's a little bit less responsibility on the family in that respect. Mm-hmm. They're not on for managing anyone or reporting on goals or anything like that. So two different, very different programs, but two very good programs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for kind of explaining all of that. It's a lot.
Yeah.
The transition part is a lot for, I'm sure, for parents and the individual kind of to like take in to, you know, what's next for my child.
It is. And we often try to remember that families, and I mean, it can be hard, but families often have to live in the moment. They're living in the now. They can't think about what's coming down in a year from now or 2 years. So when we're throwing all this information at them, it can be overwhelming. And we often do have to have these conversations multiple times, and it's understandable,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so we try to remember that working with families, because it's not an easy time. It's an uncertain time
mm-hmm.
for both the individual and the family. So
I can imagine that it would be. So as promised, we're going to talk a little bit about Caitlin and Jillian's personal journey. Jillian, I guess we'll start with you. And please feel as comfortable as you know what you want to share. When did you first notice signs in your child that something wasn't quite right? Was it right at birth? Was it a little bit down the line?
So I had my son very young. Well, I say very young. I was 20. And he has Down syndrome. And I did not find this out until about 2 days after he was born. I will say my hope is that things have gotten better since then with the way that they present information like that. Because I know, and I think I can relate to a lot of families when I say delivery was troublesome. You know, when you hear from a doctor, oh, you know, are you aware that your son is deformed? How do you respond to that? You know what I mean? Especially right. as a first-time mom, and you're like, no, my son looks beautiful, perfect to me, you know? So that was an adjustment. It was an adjustment to learn what is Down syndrome. I don't even think I know what that is. I mean, I might have met someone with Down syndrome, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was a single mom for a very long time, navigating his services. He had Easter Seals services when he was younger, and they were phenomenal. I couldn't have asked for something better. I forgot your questions now, because I got a little emotional with that one.
No, that's okay. I'll just pose the same question to Caitlin. You know, when did you find out that your, you know, child had a disability, and you know, was it right away? Was it down the line? Or
so my son's a twin, and he and his sister were born a minute apart, and the day that he was born, they said, you can't see him, there's something wrong with him. And I said, excuse me? And they said, you can see her, you can't see him. And they had a swarm of doctors. And Theo, he was diagnosed with a physical disability called torticollis. He was referred to Early Sports and Services the day he was born. He received early intervention from Gateways starting at 8 weeks old. And we thought he just had physical disability. That's how we learned. I mean, we didn't think, we were told, hey, you'll be with ESS for a couple months and then he'll be fine. You know, it's torticollis. It's not a big deal. It's just some delays. And that wasn't our story, but that's what we were told.
Can we just back up a little bit?
Yeah.
So doctors.
Yeah.
Like what are we doing to educate doctors in the way they present this information to their patients?
Yeah, I think Jillian can take it if she wants, but we've heard terrible things from doctors. I mean, when he was 12 weeks old, I was told he would never walk and talk, but there was no diagnosis and he was too complex. So, you know, those are the things that we have to remind ourselves that that's what parents are getting for information. When they walk through those doors of Gateways for their early sports and services evaluation, that's why the team needs to greet them with as much compassion and care and let's refer you to other places and let's see, you know, let's look at what they can do. A lot of our services aren't talking about what we're hearing in a medical room about what they can't do. It's what can they do? Look, you have a beautiful child and they can roll over. How exciting is that? And we celebrate those little tiny milestones that everyday people take for granted. Mm-hmm. You know, it might take someone 2 years to brush their teeth independently, and every step is celebrated, but we did it. And most five-year-olds can brush their teeth pretty well. So it's about celebrating those little moments within Gateways. It's about making sure we greet every family with as much compassion as we can and know that a lot of the times they're coming from a very defensive mindset because they might have been told not the greatest things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. I love that, what you said, you know, let's celebrate, you know, what they can do instead of focusing on what they can't do. And I'm sure that's like kind of a big relief. You know, when parents walk in the door, they're, you know, probably don't know what to expect, you know.
One of the things, and I will say this is probably not something that many people would do. Mm-hmm. I don't think, looking back, that I probably would have if I wasn't where I was at, is I actually stayed with that pediatrician, the one who gave me the information in that negative way, for several years actually after. And I have to say, I think if anything, it was a teachable moment for him. I think over the years, I don't think that he had much experience or knowledge around Down syndrome. He just thought he has Down syndrome, so he must have X, Y, and Z wrong with him. My son didn't have any of that. So for over several years, I stayed with him. It may have just been because I was overwhelmed and I couldn't imagine switching doctors because that was just like beyond my comprehension at that time. But we used a lot of his appointments to educate him around, or like ask him to like do research. Like, you're saying that this is a thing, but I'm hearing this. Now, I do want to preface, families have enough going on and they shouldn't have to do that. But it worked in our, I feel like by the time this doctor retired, we had taught him something about how to perceive someone with a disability. So I use every opportunity as a teachable moment when I see someone looking at my son differently or taking that in. And it's not an easy thing to do because we have so much going on in our lives. And sometimes we just want to cry when we see someone making faces at our kid or acting like they're scared of them because they may look different. But I think if we don't educate them and we just say, you know, move on, just don't look, like whatever, like that, we're not really doing a service to anyone in that situation.
So here you are at 20 years old, and you're expecting, you know, doctors to give you the information you need. How did you just all of a sudden start doing your own research right away? Or how did you start, like, learning about your son's Down syndrome and what you need to do to find the appropriate care for him?
I would definitely say that Easter Seals, the early support and services we got through Easter Seals, was phenomenal. It really helped kind of give me some hope for the future. I also connected with the New Hampshire Down Syndrome Association, and they were really helpful just to have some kind of community behind you that could relate and connect to in that time. And of course, I did my own research, but ultimately, if I didn't have those types of community agencies connecting to me, I don't know that.
And My son was serviced through Gateways Early Sports and Services, and same experience. You know, I will say we were seen by Boston's Children's Hospital, numerous teams. He's seen like every department at this point. It wasn't them who diagnosed him with one of his diagnoses. It was during the COVID pandemic on a Zoom call with an ESS provider. And she's like, I think he has hemifacial microsomia. I've only seen it once in my career. And I think he has it. I'm going to get you a referral and let's see if he has. And we got down and we went to the craniofacial and they said, absolutely, that's the diagnosis. And it was through Zoom, an iPad Zoom call outside at 2 years old. And it, you know, he had seen genetics. He had seen feeding and swallowing. He had seen neurology. He had seen everyone and no one knew except for that ESS provider. So I don't know if today I would even know that that was one of his diagnoses without an ESS provider. And that's how knowledgeable the early sports and services providers that see children every day and the number of children they see, they're extremely knowledgeable and they're needed.
And they seem to be, you know, kind of in tune.
Yeah.
You know, when they're working with the child, you know, every day, Easter sales, Gateways, they kind of probably pick up that kind of stuff through their experience. So after you got that diagnosis for your son, like what happened? Did you go back to the doctor?
So hemifacial microsomia. So it is a congenital disorder where half of his body is underdeveloped in comparison to the other half of his body. And as he grows, it will become more noticeable as a young child. We can see it in his eyes and his smile and it's, you know, head to toe. But what happened after is about six months after that, we were at a neurology appointment and the neurologist said to me, oh, you have your developmental eval tomorrow. Our PCP was wonderful. She referred us to developmental eval just to do it before 3. And I said, yeah, we do. And he was having a bit of a challenging time over a toy in the office. And she said, well, I just want to let you know, brace yourself for autism. And I said, I'm sorry. And she said, brace yourself for autism. Now, I have worked in the field for a long time. I'm a BCBA. I've worked with individuals with autism since I was literally 16 years old in an ESY program. And I didn't know my son had autism that day. I had no idea that day that was even on the table. And I got in the car and I was like, no, there's no way. And as I started to fill out the assessment and started to think about it, and that feeling of true denial is a real thing as a parent, where you just try to, all these other things are going on, let's block this one out too. And as we were going through, I got off the evaluation, and you have to wait 2 weeks till they get you the results. And I remember being like, yeah, it is autism. But again, I had how many years in the field, and I didn't know.
It's when we have blinders on, right?
Yeah.
Because we're, again, in the moment, in focusing in on our child for that moment. That's why I say, like, we can't always see the bigger picture in our own lives, but it's easier for us to see it in someone else's and bring that support to them.
Wow, that's amazing. And the denial of, you didn't even think it was, you know, autism. And you're a professional in the field, like you said, and you didn't even recognize it.
Yep. Yeah, and I was planning for global developmental delay. That's what I was planning for. And okay, we'll get this on, and then we'll get him into preschool in the school system at 3. And it was a whole different, oh my gosh, okay, well now we have all these other things going on. Let's try to figure this out. So
once you did kind of like accept the diagnosis of autism, what was that like for you? I mean,
I don't know that much changed. I mean, my son had early sports and services, outpatient PT, outpatient speech, outpatient OT for everything else going on, that it was just, okay, we have a label to make sense of this all. Okay. It didn't really necessarily, he was already in such intensive treatment. I think for us, as he begins to get older, we start to notice it more. So my son does talk in full sentences. He can communicate probably from all that therapy he's had, and he, you know, he does walk and run and all of those fun things, but as we see him in stress situations, we can definitely pick up on the stimming, or we notice that he doesn't know how to go up and greet someone or how to make friends at a playground, and we start to see those pieces, and it's like those moments where I'm like, okay, yeah, we are in this. But there are moments that he shines and he does fantastic, and he sang in his concert with the kindergarten class, and how wonderful was that, you know? And it wasn't like that he has autism in that moment. It was, he was a kindergartner singing in his concert. So.
And I think that that's just what it is. Like our individuals, you know, families with individuals with disabilities in their family, like they celebrate milestones that others take for granted, because it's that's what we live by. Like same with my son, he's 16 now, and you know, all his friends are getting, well, not all of his friends, but a lot of his friends around him are getting their license, they're doing all these huge milestones, and he's nowhere near there, and that gap does get bigger the older that he gets. And mm-hmm. I think it, even though he may not show it, it does affect him in some ways, and helping him kind of navigate that can be tricky.
Oh, thank you. Thank you both for your stories. I just want to ask one more question before we kind of wrap it up. And that would be, what advice would you give to other parents who are just beginning this journey? Jillian, and then I'll go with Caitlin.
I would say be patient with yourself. You're not alone, even when you feel like you're alone. And reach out and ask the questions. Yeah.
Caitlin?
I'd reiterate, ask those questions, take the time, do what you can to learn, but also try to just enjoy being a parent sometimes. I think those moments where we can just sit there and be like, yeah, I'm playing with my son and I'm enjoying it. Don't get so stuck in the diagnosis or stuck in needing to know more. Try to enjoy those small moments.
Thank you so much for sharing. Thanks for being here and offering your personal perspectives as parents, and to our listeners for joining us for today's episode of Gateways, a Lifeline for a Lifetime. We hope this conversation gave you a deeper look into how Gateway supports children and families at every stage and setting. To learn more about the programs we discussed, visit www.gatewayscs.org. Don't miss our future episodes, in which we'll continue to explore the people, programs, and stories that shape our work. Thank you.